This program is intended for blind people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading news articles from various news services on the subject of religion. From The Economist first, of April 6th, Religion and Human Rights. A good Russian is vindicated on the Orthodox Church's holy day. Light prevails over darkness, in one case at least. Today is Good Friday in the Orthodox Christian calendar. All over the Eastern Christian world, from villages in Greece and Romania to cathedrals in Moscow, it is a day for haunting ceremonies that reenact the death and burial of Jesus. There are chants of deep lamentation interlaced with quietly confident declarations that mortality has been conquered and life will prevail. This builds up to the noisy, exuberant resurrection festivities which take place on the night from Saturday to Sunday. This year, for some rank-and-file or Russian Orthodox believers, the story of a just man unfairly accused but ultimately vindicated has even greater poignancy. To the relief of human rights campaigners inside and outside Russia, a brave historian who has devoted his life to uncovering, literally and metaphorically, the crimes of the Stalin era, was largely acquitted this week of the surreal charges that had been laid against him. Prosecutors were demanding a 9-year prison term. A court in northwestern Russia cleared Yuri Dmitriev of most of accusations he faced, including those of child pornography and depravity, which were based on photographs he took to trace the development of his infirm adopted daughter. As head of the local branch of Memorial, an organization which investigates and records the atrocities of Soviet times, he had uncovered a mass grave near his hometown of Petrovozovsk and shown that it contained victims of the Great Terror of the 1930s. His arrest in December 2016 was universally seen by supporters as a cynical attempt to muzzle him. Only one charge, that of possessing, quote, parts of a firearm, was upheld, and he will face certain restrictions on his freedom for several months as a result. But as a whole, the verdict was a great relief. The politically compliant hierarchs who will lead this weekend's Easter ceremonies in the biggest churches of Moscow have not had much to say about his touchstone human rights saga, but at lower levels of the church it's been different. Father Alexei Yuminsky, a cleric who has won respect as shepherd of an Orthodox community in central Moscow for 3 decades, recorded a video in which he spoke of absolute confidence in Mr. Dmitriev's innocence and his own deep respect for the campaigner's work to uncover the crimes of the atheist Soviet regime. The priest assured Mr. Dmitriev that thousands of believers were praying for his acquittal and compared him to the persecuted Christians to whom St. Paul addressed his epistles. The video was posted on a popular and well-connected Russian Orthodox website, which is far from being a nest of liberal thinking on theology or anything else. And the fact that Mr. Dmitriev faced such charges is an indicator of some very dark forces at work in Russia. Forces that don't want people to be aware of the horrific human consequences of totalitarianism. As Father Alexei and his flock will doubtless be reflecting this Easter weekend, the outcome was a welcome reminder that dark forces don't always get their own way, especially when they are confronted with absolute integrity. And from the Religion News Service now of April 5th, how a businessman is reshaping the Anti-Defamation League in an age of white nationalism. Jonathan Greenblatt was working at the White House when he got a call from a headhunter wondering if he'd be interested in a job running the Anti-Defamation League. She couldn't be serious, he thought. As director of the Obama White House's Social Innovation Office, Greenblatt figured the headhunter didn't really want him. She only wanted him to connect her to the right person. After all, Greenblatt was a businessman. He had earned his stripes as an entrepreneur who started a handful of firms, including Ethos Water, the bottled water company now owned by Starbucks, which he co-founded with a business school classmate as a way to support water relief in the developing world. And I thought, ADL is a civil rights organization. I'm not a civil rights expert, he said. ADL is all lawyers, and I'm not a lawyer. ADL is a Jewish organization. I've never worked in the Jewish community. Still, his wife had worked as associate director of the ADL's Los Angeles office before the couple moved to D.C. So, as a courtesy, he decided to meet with the headhunter. 3 years later, he has become the public face of the ADL. His utterances about anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry served daily through press releases, tweets, conferences, and TV news spots. In that time, he has managed to distance his showman predecessor Abraham Foxman with a sober, studious, and sometimes starchy demeanor, railing against the dangers facing Jews and other minorities, the twin pillars of the ADL's mission. Where Foxman was avuncular and often melodramatic, Greenblatt, age 47, is businesslike and shrewd. Since taking over in July 2015, he has brought a business and marketing acumen, capped by a tech-savvy sophistication, to a 105-year-old nonprofit organization based in New York. He opened a Silicon Valley office on top of the ADL's 26 regional offices, plus one in Israel. He chose San Francisco as the venue for its second annual TED-style conference, Never Is Now, drawing activists and leaders from Facebook, Twitter, and other heavy hitters of high tech to fight hate speech online. This year, he is reorganizing the ADL's unwieldy 300-member National Commission, creating a 17 to 23-member board of directors more in line with other nonprofit organizations. But if Greenblatt took the job thinking he could bring the ADL into the 21st century, history had a bigger plan. The presidency of Donald Trump and the rise of white nationalism in the U.S. as well as abroad have given him a challenge and a pulpit his predecessor never had. The rebirth of nationalism in the form of neo-Nazi, alt-right, and other far-right political activists has unleashed a wave of online vitriol and, in some cases, violent hate crimes directed at Jews, Muslims, blacks, Hispanics, and immigrants. In 2017 alone, anti-Semitism surged 57%, the largest single-year increase on record, as the ADL documented. At the same time, instances of left-wing anti-Semitism, such as the D.C. council member who suggested Jewish financiers control the weather, or the Women's March organization's support for Louis Farrakhan's anti-Semitic rants, not to mention the British Labour Party's Jeremy Corbyn problem, have also been rising. Consider that the Republican candidate for Illinois' 3rd Congressional District, Arthur Jones, is a self-declared Nazi and a Holocaust denier. What we've seen is a normalization of some of the worst kinds of rhetoric seeping into supposedly legitimate quarters, said Greenblatt. It's really chilling. Greenblatt doesn't have magical solutions, but he's trying to tackle hate in novel ways, by forging strong ties with Muslims and other minority groups, partnering with the social media giants on efforts to reduce cyber hate, and, where possible, galvanizing public opinion through campaigns such as Mayor's Compact, an ADL initiative that enlisted 300 U.S. mayors to commit to fighting hate and extremism. His single most dramatic initiative may be his willingness to engage Muslims. When the U.S. Senate considers President Trump's choice to lead the State Department in a few weeks, the ADL will issue a list of critical questions for lawmakers to consider, as it does before many such confirmations. Greenblatt has already said he has serious concerns about the fitness of Mike Pompeo to serve as Secretary of State due to his, quote, hostility to Muslims and his track record of trafficking in anti-Muslim conspiracy theories. Founded to combat the mistreatment of Jews, the ADL is now defending Muslims from Islamophobia, too. When Trump proposed a Muslim registry shortly before taking office, Greenblatt responded, "The day they create a Muslim registry is the day I register as a Muslim." He has also hired an Arab-American expert in countering violent extremism as senior vice president of programs. George Salim, who worked for the Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations in various roles, including directing the Countering Violent Extremism Task Force in the Department of Homeland Security, and serving as a government liaison to the Muslim American community, now plays a big role at the ADL. Salem directs the ADL's Center on Extremism and oversees its education and law enforcement training programs. The ADL reaches more than 1.5 million school children every year with its K-12 anti-bias, anti-hate educational programs. In conjunction with the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, it also offers a one-day training to all FBI agents and many of the nation's largest police departments on ways to fight extremism. In March, for example, it trained the Seattle Police Force. A Catholic of Egyptian and Lebanese descent, Salim said he was drawn to the ADL because of its commitment not only to combating anti-Semitism, but also to securing justice and fair treatment for all. What makes working there such an appealing place for me is to be post-government, is that I can continue the mission of working on all forms of hatred and bigotry and extremism, said Salim. And while that emphasis on justice and fair treatment for all has been part of the ADL since its founding, back in the early years it was the cornerstone of black-Jewish relations, its ties to the Muslim community have not always been so sturdy. Foxman famously opposed the Park 51 Islamic Center, also known as the Ground Zero Mosque in Lower Manhattan. He also praised Daniel Pipes, a prominent anti-Muslim commentator, and donated to his Middle East Forum. Like his predecessor, Greenblatt remains opposed to the Iran nuclear deal. Partly that may be because his wife, an Iranian Jewish refugee, was forced to escape the country in her teens wearing a hijab. And partly it may be his desire to defend Israel from Iran's militaristic obsession with destroying it. But there's little doubt that Greenblatt understands that hate begets hate, and defending the rights of one group ultimately leads to defending the rights of others. The thing about the ADL is that it's always understood that anti-Semitism doesn't live in a vacuum, said Jill Jacobs, executive director of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. You can't just fight anti-Semitism without fighting other kinds of racism. Even before Greenblatt assumed his role at the ADL, the organization had already realized that anti-Semitism's reach extended far beyond swastikas spray-painted on Jewish day schools and overturned graves at Jewish cemeteries. Anti-Semitism, like other kinds of hate, lives and thrives on the Internet. In 2012, the ADL launched an anti-cyber hate working group with Silicon Valley's tech giants, Facebook, Google, YouTube, Microsoft, Twitter, and Yahoo. 2 years later, the group issued a set of best practices for the industry. But Foxman remained frustrated by his limited success with internet companies' willingness to scrub hate and bigotry online. We've been talking to the geniuses at Palo Alto, Foxman told JTA in 2013. We have said to them, thanks but no thanks. You developed a technology that has some wonderful things but also unintended consequences. Greenblatt takes a different tack. His enthusiasm for new media marks him as a member of a younger generation. And for years, his years of working in California, he started an open source platform for volunteers called All for Good and served as CEO of the media company Good Worldwide, convince him partnering with the tech giants is the only way to go. Jonathan can bring his business background and say, look, I get you. How do we come up with a solution that benefits both you as well as the greater community, said Adlai Wertman, professor of social entrepreneurship at the Marshall School of the University of Southern California. If you don't understand what Facebook does for a living and what they value, then it's impossible to move them. In 2016, Greenblatt opened a Center for Technology and Society in Silicon Valley and hired Britton Heller, a former prosecutor from the Department of Justice's legacy Nazi hunting section, who also served as a computer hacking and intellectual property specialist, to run it. The center's first act was to issue a report detailing a troubled year-long rise in anti-Semitic hate directed at mostly Jewish journalists on Twitter. The 2016 report showed that a small number of user accounts, about 1,600 mostly white nationalists, attacked some 800 U.S. journalists with anti-Semitic and racial tirades on Twitter. That may seem like a small number, but Heller likened the online echo chamber of those tweets to the equivalent of buying a $20 million Super Bowl ad. Twitter ultimately responded by suspending those accounts and changing its terms of service to make it easier for the social media giant to boot out purveyors of hate. Last year, YouTube announced a set of policies aimed at curbing extremist videos on the platform. The ADL's Silicon Valley office is now partnering with the University of California, Berkeley, to create an algorithm that can discern the difference between hate speech and non-hate speech. Recent developments have led many to wonder whether social media, which was intended to promote community and connection, has become too unwieldy and too dangerous for democracy. The fake news problems in the recent Cambridge Analytical scandal, in which Facebook exposed data on 87 million of its users, is giving many people pause about partnering with the media giants. But Greenbat is pragmatic. Frankly, NGOs like ours, on our own, will not solve the problem, he said. I think it's going to take a combination of points of pressure. It takes political pressure, public pressure, the likes of which we can generate, and other groups, and that ordinary people can generate. And it also takes market pressure. And where Greenblatt can apply pressure, he will. For all his business know-how, Greenblatt is also deeply motivated by his Jewish identity and concern for Jewish continuity. Growing up in Turnbull, Connecticut, he attended a conservative synagogue and celebrated his bar mitzvah at 13. One member of his family, his grandfather Bernard, had an outsized influence on him. Bernard Greenblatt was born in Magdeburg, a central German city on the Elbe River with a Jewish population dating back to the 10th century. As an adult, he moved east to Danzig, now Gdansk, Poland. In 1938, he made it to the U.S., settling in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Greenblatt calls his grandfather a Holocaust survivor, and while Bernard escaped the genocidal policies of the Third Reich, his experience as a refugee had a profound impact on Jonathan's outlook. As a college student at Tufts University, Jonathan Greenblatt spent a semester abroad visiting Magdeburg and other German cities where he found no Jews. The realization was painful, and when he returned to the United States, he vowed he would work to stem anti-Semitism. In his senior year, he found his way to the Boston office of the Anti-Defamation League and convinced the office's director, legendary civil rights leader Leonard Zakim, to create an internship for him. Greenblatt called that internship life-changing. I learned about hate crimes, anti-bias education, said. I learned about interfaith events. They did a black Jewish seder, which was amazing. It was a great experience. When college was over, still, Greenblatt enrolled at the Kellogg School of Management in Northwestern University and from there launched his business career. In his first job, he worked for Realtor.com. But it was an ADL connection from his college internship that led to an introduction to his wife, Marianne Kipur Greenblatt. After settling in Los Angeles, she worked as an associate director of the Los Angeles ADL office. He briefly served on the board of the Jewish Community Foundation. Though he may tell it differently, when the offer came to lead the ADL, there were plenty of personal touchstones that made the offer particularly attractive. 3 years in, most in the Jewish community praise the work he's done. Still, Greenblatt has had to fend off the fears of Jewish conservatives that he was an Obama liberal who would be insufficiently supportive of Israel, as some have accused the former president of being. The Zionist Organization of America, which has sided with the Trump administration, including former aide Steve Bannon, has been his loudest critic. But Greenblatt has also been targeted by Jews on the left, particularly those organizations working to end the occupation. Some of these activists consider Greenblatt too soft on Israel. I don't think ADL is taking a partisan line, said Jonathan Wiseman, author of Semitism, Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump, and a New York Times editor. I actually think they should be more assertive. Greenblatt appears to have found a centrist Jewish voice, and many Jewish leaders are giving him credit for it. You have to call out your allies when they make excuses, whether it's for Louis Farrakhan or Richard Spencer, said Noam Neusner, who served as a speechwriter and liaison to Jewish communities for former President George W. Bush. These are people who are corroding American life and turning America against itself. It's a challenge, but I think Jonathan is up to it. Now, Greenblatt wants to remind Jews of their immigrant story. He just wrote a foreword to John F. Kennedy's 1958 classic, A Nation of Immigrants, which HarperCollins is reissuing later this year. The ADL is predicated on this idea that when America is good for Jews, it's good for all its people, Greenblatt said. And when it's good for all its people, it's also good for the Jews. And from the Associated Press now of April 6th, dioceses are IDing priests and a bishop and lay people in an abuse probe. The Roman Catholic Diocese of Erie, Pennsylvania, on Friday, April 6th, made public the names of 34 priests or other members of the clergy who faced credible allegations of sexual abuse or misconduct over the years, including their bishop in the 1970s, who they say failed to stop abuse that was reported to him. In an unusual step, the diocese also identified 17 lay men and women facing similar claims, including a Catholic high school teacher who went on to become a college president. It's the first time the sprawling 13-county, 200,000-member diocese in the state's northwest corner has put out a comprehensive list of those accused of abuse, which range from providing children with pornography to sexual assault. As Catholics, we believe the Lord has infinite mercy and absolution for those who are contrite and sincerely seek forgiveness, said Bishop Lawrence Persico, but that does not mean they are free from the ramifications of their behavior. The allegations reach back 7 decades. 21 of the priests and 2 of the lay people on the list are deceased. None are now serving in any capacity with the Church. The document put out by the diocese lists where most of those named are believed to be living and any punishment they have received, from being removed from the priesthood to being sent to prison, which was the case for a handful of the lay people. Bishop Alfred Watson, who led the diocese until the early 1980s, is cited for allegedly failing to stop abuse that was deemed to have been credibly reported to him. He died in 1990. William Garvey, who died last year, had faced accusations he abused minors while he was a lay high school teacher and basketball coach. He would go on to become president of Mercyhurst College in Erie. The diocese's decision to put out the list came as the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office is wrapping up a grand jury investigation into how the Erie Diocese and 5 others in Pennsylvania have handled abuse and other allegations over the years. The Church said it is tightening its policies to protect children from future abuse, including increasing the clearances needed to work with youth. Law enforcement is currently investigating 3 people not on the list of 51, including 2 priests who were identified by the diocese back in February and have either resigned or been removed from the Church, the diocese said. Diocesan spokeswoman Anne Marie Welsh said staff had begun looking into allegations dating as far back as 1944, even before the grand jury investigation began in 2016. She said Persico, who became bishop in 2012, invited local prosecutors to look at the diocese files early in his tenure, but that process was suspended once the state investigation began. The Erie Diocese list is different from most other lists released by dioceses around the country because it includes the names of lay people who worked with Catholic schools or as volunteers with churches or affiliated agencies, the bishop said. About 35 of the 145 dioceses in the U.S., or roughly 25%, have released names of credibly accused priests, including 2 others in Pennsylvania, according to the group bishopaccountability.org. Terry McKiernan, its president, said naming lay people was unusual. Quote, there are various ways that the diocese reduced the number on their list, so increasing the number by including lay people is a positive step and might be unique in these lists. He said, McKiernan said, adding that his group has called on the diocese to include comprehensive work histories for the accused as well. Jeff Anderson, a St. Paul, Minnesota lawyer whose firm only handles cases of abuse survivors, said the diocese has made, quote, preemptive minimal effort in light of the grand jury investigation. And back to the Religion News Service now of April 6th. Celebrating a medieval miracle of Amsterdam, in a city better known for its vices. Several thousand faithful braved below-freezing wind chills on a recent weekend night and filed quietly through the streets of a city more typically known for its red light district vices than for its religiosity. The hour-long Stille Omgang, or Silent Walk, held nearly every year on a Saturday night around midnight a couple weeks before Easter, commemorates a medieval miracle in a post-Reformation time when Catholics were forbidden from displaying their faith publicly. It's a subdued ritual that stands in contrast to the extravagant processions found in other countries with a rich Catholic heritage. As we walked up quietly with strangers past strip clubs, sex shops, restaurants, and expensive clothing stores, as well as a McDonald's and a Burger King, we were struck by the 673-year-old celebration's endurance and power against all odds. Amsterdam's status during the 17th century Dutch Golden Age, the era of Rembrandt, Vermeer, and Spinoza, is well known. But in the Middle Ages, before the expansion of the canals, what was then mostly a fishing village became a pilgrimage site after the so-called Miracle of Amsterdam. On March 15th, 1345, a priest administered the last rites to a dying man who had lived in an Amsterdam street called Carverstraat. The sick man vomited the communion host, which, per custom, was cast into a fire. The next morning, however, the sacrament was intact, untouched by the flames like Moses' burning bush. It was preserved as a sacred relic, which attracted pilgrims. Later, after the city became Protestant in 1578, Catholics, Baptists, and other Christians who didn't belong to the Calvinist Reformed Church practiced their faiths in Schuurkerken, or hidden churches, which remained beautiful on the inside, but often looked like ordinary canal houses on the outside. There was, however, tolerance of houses of worship for foreign faiths, notably of Jewish synagogues. By the 17th and 18th centuries, Amsterdam's Catholic minority marched in commemoration of the miracle, but did so silently due to laws restricting their public worship. The silent ritual walk reportedly draws up to 5,000 people. Congregations typically gather for Mass at their church and then walk together as a group. Groups overlap as stragglers mingle with the speedy front lines of other communities, and the walk is to be completed over the course of several hours. We tagged along behind a church from the south of the country and was one of about 550 people in a larger group traversing the route. The group was mostly middle-aged and well above that, including quite a few seniors, although earlier in the day a version was held that catered to children. The nighttime program started with an hour-long Mass in Dutch that began at 10:30 p.m. The two-story chapel, heir to a destroyed Catholic church associated with the miracle, is devoted to Saints Johannes and Ursula. Some Amsterdammers, especially motorists, treated the groups as the same way American drivers treat funeral processions, by giving way. It helped that police stopped traffic around the route. But if there's something in the silence of this modern pilgrimage that feels more powerful than the city's trappings, it made the night feel quiet and meditative. Well, that's all the time we have now for Religion in the News. This has been Michael Blakely. I'll talk to you later.